Peter Sagal is the host of NPR's incredibly successful show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But
I hate the title of my radio show. I have always hated the title of my radio show.
You know what else he hates? The place where he works.
Navy g- pier. It's beautiful. It's lovely. It's on the lake of wonderful
Navy
views.
Pier.
I'm Charlie Meyerson. Those are just two of the revelations that emerged when Peter Sagal and I met on stage as part of the Wednesday Journal newspaper Conversations series to talk about the show, his career, the challenge sexual harassment poses for comedy, the Constitution under Donald Trump, and much more, including his affection for the town we both call home, Oak Park, Illinois. Now here's how it went with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal at Dominican University in River Forest, November 20th, 2017.
So you're Peter Sagal.
I am.
It'll take you a while, if you've never seen me before, to get used to what I look like.
Yeah, because you don't look at all like this.
No,
on the
I don't look at all like, well, you saw pictures, so I guess it's easier now. Tonight's festivities, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming, come in four parts. Oak Park, and yes, we'll get to River Forest. Part two, the non-wait-wait stuff. Part three, wait-wait, tell me. That's not original, I bet, is
no,
it?
No.
You've heard that a zillion times. You've probably said
never
it a zillion
before.
Times. And then many, many questions that you have submitted in advance. So part one, Peter, a lot of people won't remember that you haven't hosted Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from the start. How did those early years of your relationship with WBEZ and National Public Radio in Chicago unfold?
Well, it was early months, actually. What happened, as I remember it, was I was living in Brooklyn, New York, with my then wife, who was at the time pregnant with our first child, now a sophomore at the University of Chicago. And I got a call from a friend of mine who said, hey, I know these people on public radio who are putting together a new show for NPR. It's going to be a news quiz of some kind. They're looking for funny people who read a lot of newspapers, and I thought of you, said my friend. Would you like to be in it? Would you like to be involved? And I was like, yes, because I listened to public radio all the time. I was a writer living at home, and it was my company most of the day. And like all people, I assume, who listen to public radio, I secretly thought I could do it better. Right, everybody? Anyway, so I was like, yes, and then I was called by a producer named David Green, and I auditioned, and the next thing I know, I was a panelist in the very first iteration of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Usually you call it version, but it's public radio, so we say iteration. And the show went on the air, based from the beginning here in Chicago's WBEZ, and to use a technical term from the radio business, which I've learned over the years, it sucked. I think 20 years later I can actually say this. I mean, for a while I needed to be diplomatic, but it was really bad. Did anybody hear any of those very first episodes, January of 1998? Yes, sir. Right there. You were in the minority. Public radio is, in fact, a very conservative medium. And by that I don't mean politically, I mean in terms of they don't like change. You can tell that because your favorite shows have been in the air for 80 years. Some shows are on the air so long they actually last longer than the lives of the people hosting it, right? And people did not like the change in the schedule here in Chicago and in the other stations that had chosen to put on the show, and they let us know quite vociferously. And the show, I did not think, and certainly not a lot of people thought, was very good, and so they needed to make a change quickly. And they had already done national auditions and ended up with what they had, so they didn't have any more time, so I was sort of given a battlefield promotion. For reasons that I'm not quite sure I understand to this day, but apparently I sounded hosty. And so they upgraded me from panelist to host. I moved to Chicago in April of that year, and hosted my first show in May of 1998, and have been doing it ever since.
So you're getting ready to move to Chicago.
I am.
Somewhat quickly.
Rather quickly.
And you pick Oak Park?
Yes.
Why?
Well, we were moving to Chicago, and I have mentioned that our first child, My daughter had just been born, so we were going to be parents in Chicago. And what everybody told us was, if you're going to raise kids in Chicago, you want to live in Oak Park or Evanston. This is the conventional wisdom. And I had a real problem. I mean, there are also, you may be aware, there are many other towns you could live in. All of which weirdly have the words forest, river, or park in their name somewhere. But the problem was I had grown up in the suburbs. I had grown up in the real suburbs of suburban New Jersey, and I hated it. And I did not want to live in the suburbs. And so Oak Park and Evanston struck me as a compromise, because it was a suburb, technically, but it was also kind of miserable. And so, you know, there was crime and there was problems, and I was like, oh, as long as like there's enough crime and problems that I feel gritty, I can live with it. And also, it's not flattery. There was also this realtor who's sitting in this room. She's one of the sponsors, Patty Sprafko Wagner, who simply would not let us live anywhere else. Honest to God, I honestly believed that if we tried to buy a house in, say, Evanston, she would have appeared like an avenging angel and dragged us back here. So yeah, we bought our first house on East Avenue, just south of Madison, in Oak Park in 1998, and I've lived here ever since. In fact, I now live in my fourth home in Oak Park because I can't leave.
Four houses.
I know.
I mean, and you're a big deal. You could, I presume, live in a lot of places other than Oak Park. Why did you keep coming back?
Well, I'm a big deal. I'm going to tell a story about Patty. So the time had come to sell that first house 5 years after we bought it, and we're going to move into a bigger house because we had acquired more children somehow. Still unclear on how that happens. At any rate, so Patty came over, and we were trying to set the price. She also sold the house, and we were trying to set the correct price. And I said to her, I have a really dumb question. And she said, there are no dumb questions. And I said, do you think it would matter in terms of increasing the price that it's like my house? And she said, and I am quoting you, that is a dumb question.
Because the answer was?
It's not even worth trying to answer. But no, I live in Oak Park mainly, but we moved to Oak Park because of all the reasons that people live in Oak Park, the excellent schools, and now my children are here. They remain here. I have a freshman and a senior at Oak Park River Forest High School. Long may it rain. And so I'll be here as long as they are, certainly.
Okay, equal time. Why not River Forest?
You know what? I can actually tell you, because we were driving around with Patty, and we were driving up and down the streets of Oak Park, and there was crap in all the front yards. There was gardens, or there was toys that had been left there by kids, remains of lemonade stands. There was just stuff. And in River Forest, there was nothing. And this is true. And we decided that, in addition to the economic issue, that we would rather live in a place where people were out leaving crap in their front yards. And of course, there's the kind of crap you want. You want, like, toys and, you know, you don't want cars on blocks. That was like, you want to get right in the sweet spot of crap in front yards. That's where you want to live.
So as you've lived in Oak Park all these years,
yes.
And I can attest to this because we've met just once before on the L. You mm-hmm. take the L frequently mm-hmm. into the city.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen you with your little portable bike, your fold-up bike.
I do. I love my portable bike.
And as far as I could tell on that train ride, no one was bothering you except me.
Yes.
How often do you get bothered by people who do recognize you?
Almost never. And we were talking about this earlier. I have the best kind of fame. It is a scale model of actual fame. It is to what real fame is what your train set in your basement, if you have one, is to an actual train. In that there are some similarities. You can understand how the real thing works, but it is not the real thing. And one of the ways it works is that, unlike other people who are actually famous, if you don't really know and like what I do, you have no idea I exist. So I'm just not ubiquitous. So if you're a public radio fan, and I assume you all are here because you paid to come here to me talk, then you will like what I do, and you'll have an appreciation for it, and you will be very polite about expressing that, because you're public radio fans. If you aren't a public radio fan, I am nobody. And so I can walk down the street completely unaccosted.
Have you ever had a bad encounter with someone who is familiar with your work?
The fact that one does not leap to mind probably indicates no. I mean, you all are very polite people. And who would be mad at me? Nobody gets up in my face and says, "Your jokes are trite." What's the point? So no, I've never had, every now and then, and it happens infrequently, and I'm kind of insulted by this, the right-wing media machine will pick up on us because they've got nothing better to talk about, and they'll talk about Peter Sagal, the host of this show, said this awful thing, and we'll get this little burst of hate mail, which is pretty intense. But not as intense as the hate mail that we get from vegans whenever we make fun of vegans. Which, by the way, just makes me do it more. So.
Part two.
Yes.
Non-weight-weight
yes.
stuff.
Yes.
You're working on what I find to be a bewildering assortment of new projects.
Yes, that is.
What are you working on? Run them down.
Well, let's see. Right now, you catch me at a weirdly busy time. Right now, I'm trying to finish this book that was due years ago, and various events interfered. But now I'm sort of doing a third rewrite on it. Hopefully, it'll be ready for publication in 2018. Doing Wait, obviously.
Wait, can you tell us what the book's about?
Yeah, it's called. Well, you may have heard that. I happened to be at the Boston Marathon, and I had just crossed the line with this blind runner, and it basically starts with that and ends with the next year's marathon, and there's a lot about running and a little bit about my life, which was a rather tumultuous year in my personal life, and so it's all about basically from one Boston Marathon to the next with lots of thoughts about running and related issues in between.
You told me, and I want to explore this a little bit further. I have inside information. So it's the overarching theme is running through a midlife crisis.
Sort of. The book is called Keep Going because as I was going through this sort of personal issue, this person who I hardly knew, she was a friend of a friend, but had heard of my various troubles. She came and she to my house and she gave me a mug. And the mug says, "If you're going through hell, keep going." Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, by the way, never said that. But it's a nice thought, and I found it rather useful. And if you're interested, hopefully it'll be available next year, but also I told this story for The Moth. If you happen to want to Google Moth, my name, you will find it, and that's the first chapter of the book, so there you are.
Book?
Yes, book. Yeah, so I get the book. Weirdly, I used to be a playwright, and then I got this job, and I stopped writing plays. But by bizarre coincidence, a play that I wrote many years ago that has never been produced is about to get its premiere at a theater in Florida, an old friend of mine. So that's kind of fun.
What's it about? How does it end?
It's
sorry, I'm trying to say
it's about
time.
It's about two old people who are frustrated that they can't see their grandchild as often as they want, so they take her and run. It's a comedy. And then they go to Florida where odd things happen, because that's where odd things happen. And so it's great fun. I went down there just a couple weeks ago to watch rehearsals, and I was able to use a part of my brain that I haven't used before. And somewhere along the lines, and this is the other thing, I wrote this musical with some friends. And we're going to workshop this. It's a very silly musical. It's about Silicon Valley. It's called Start Me Up, and we're going to do a workshop of it to see if it has any viability with the House Theater of Chicago, on whose board I've sat for a good 15 years. So that's kind of fun.
Can you sing or hum a few bars for us?
I cannot.
Can you recite any of the lyrics for us?
I shall not.
Can you tell us about the story arc?
Well, the thing that this will appeal to people who like musical theater. You may know, if you like musical theater, that the show often begins with the character, the lead character, singing what is called the What I Want song. And classic examples, when Something's Coming from West Side Story, or the opening number of Alexander Hamilton from My Shot is like the great modern I Want song, in which the character comes forward center stage and sings beautifully about what he or she wants. And in my show, the lead character sings, the song is called What I Want, and it's about the fact that he doesn't know what he wants. And the plot of the show, because it's in Silicon Valley, is about his attempt to invent a machine that will tell him what he wants. That kind of humor really appeals to me.
In 2013,
yes,
you hosted a PBS series on the U.S. Constitution.
I did.
I thought you might know that.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, and I know that this is a passion of yours, and it's increasingly a passion for all of us here.
Right.
As we
yes
encounter whatever's happening in this nation.
Mm-hmm.
Help us.
How should I help you?
I don't know. Well, what do you see as the role of the Constitution in this time of upheaval in our country?
All right. This may not be hopeful. So I did this documentary on the Constitution, which I was interested in as a citizen, but then I was asked to host this show for PBS, and I spent off and on parts of a year going around the country and filming it and meeting all these amazing people. I got to go back to just take one story of many. I got to go to Little Rock High School with Minnie Jean Brown, who was one of the Little Rock Nine, and it was amazing, and it was just an amazing experience. But one of the most interesting things that happened was a very minor thing, which is I was talking to Akhil Rita Mar. He's an extraordinary scholar of the U.S. Constitution, and he mentioned in passing that the Soviet Union and Communist China both have or had bills of rights. And I thought that was interesting, because I didn't think they had rights over there, and it turns out they don't. They had a Bill of Rights, which laid out all these great rights people would have, but they don't have them because people just ignored them. And I was wondering why we have them, and they don't. You just sort of take that for granted, but why, when we wrote it down, it counted, and when they wrote it down, it didn't. And the other thing I found out, by the way, is that nobody knows anything about the U.S. Constitution. Practically, nobody knows anything. They know about the First Amendment, they know about the Second Amendment, maybe they know about the Fifth or the Eighth, that's it. They don't know anything. Oh, if you grew up in a certain time, you can sing the preamble, right? We the people, in order to form a more, you know this. Anyway, but that's it. Nobody knows anything. They just assume that it guarantees them the right to do whatever it is they actually want to do. Have an abortion, walk around with guns, say what they want to say, whatever. They just assume that the Constitution means that it's a free country. So that's bad. Nobody knows anything about it. Nobody knows anything about the Supreme Court case except the very big cases you've all heard of. Nobody knows how that works. Nobody knows how jurisprudence works. Nobody knows. Yeah. So it's like we all live in civic ignorance. But what I figured out was that everybody, even if they don't know anything about the Constitution, believes in it, i.e., they have this deep understanding that there is a civil order that we all go along with. And that shows itself in various ways, that we accept the results of an election. We don't, shall we say, secede. That if there's a dispute with our neighbor, we don't get our friends to collect our weapons and go over and kill the neighbor. We go to court. And then if the court judgment comes against us, we accept it and we appeal it. That we live as civic people, and we understand there are certain rules that you just don't break. And when I used to talk about this with some fervor, I would say, and the great thing about America is not everybody, but the vast majority of people believe in this civic religion, and that's what keeps us going. And that's also what makes America America, because we don't have a common ethnicity, except maybe in this room. We don't have we don't have a common national origin. We don't have a common, you know, all the Swedes come from Swedeland, and so they have that, and they have this common history and folklore, but we don't have any of those things. What is it that we have? And we have this common civic religion, which we all believe in, even if we don't know the specifics. We believe in it. And I sort of came to this wonderful epiphany attending, and you should all do this, go to a citizenship ceremony. There's a federal building on Congress Parkway downtown. They have citizen ceremonies like three times a week. Go to one. They're amazing because there will be people from everywhere, from Ireland to Somalia, and they will be swearing the oath, and they are all Americans in the best sense. It's awesome. And so what I would say, when I used to talk about this, is that we are here, and we succeed, and we have rights, and a working constitution because everybody believes in it, from the newest immigrant, the guy who just swore himself or herself as a citizen, to the President of the United States. That's what I used to say. And I am wondering what will happen now that that's not true. And it's a little scary because it turns out that the minority of people who don't believe in this civic religion are now in charge, or at least many of them are. And it's just a question of how hard the people who do are going to push back and restrain them. Because in the end, it comes down to individual decisions. The example I gave in the documentary is I talk about Richard Nixon, who was a pretty terrible person. Not as bad as we could get, we found out, but pretty terrible. And he was a criminal, and he was a racist and anti-Semite, and he was a drunk, and people thought he was crazy toward the end. But when it came down to it, when the Supreme Court voted 9-0 that he had to hand over those last Watergate tapes, the ones that he knew implicated him in the cover-up and would get him impeached, i.e. would make him into a historical villain for the rest of time, he handed them over. He didn't have to. Supreme Court doesn't have an army. He has an army. He understood, even Richard Nixon, in that extremity, understood that you had to obey, even if it meant your personal end. And he did it, because by doing it, he, in a weird way, saved the country. Al Gore did the same thing, obviously, in 2000, when he, as he said, at the time, there's really no middle ground between accepting a Supreme Court ruling and troops in the streets. That's it. Those are the alternatives. And he understood it, and he, of course, accepted the ruling of Bush v. Gore. So that's great. So all of our leaders up until now have had that basic understanding. No matter how awful or evil or dishonest or whatever they get up to, they know that when the tire hits the road and it's time to make the decision, they will side with civic order. I don't know what will happen if that moment comes tomorrow or next month. And it could. We all can play out scenarios. And if our current president does not respond in the same way, I presume he will have people around him who are encouraging him to respond in the same way. But if he refuses, I don't know what happens. And a lot of bad things could happen.
So what is your take on the state of American constitutional government right now? Is it strong? Is it stronger than it has been because of these questions? Or is it weak, because the president is...
It's tough. I think that not enough people have watched my documentary, apparently, because there still seems to be a misunderstanding about what the Constitution really is, along the lines of I said, and that's spreading. That there are people who call themselves constitutional conservatives who are nothing of the kind. For example, the Republican candidate for Senate in Alabama. I mean, I like to say, you know, I thought Roy Moore was disgusting months ago. Before we found out all the things about young girls, the reason Roy Moore was unacceptable and is profoundly un-American is that he rejects the rule of law. He rejects the constitutional order. How do we know this? Because as a senior judge, the chief judge of Alabama, he was ordered by a superior judge, federal judge, to do a thing, in this case, remove the Ten Commandments, and he refused to do it. And that means you don't believe in the Constitution, right? I mean, if you believe that a federal judge has no power over a state judge in this area, you don't believe in the Constitution because it's right there. It's called the Supremacy Clause. So he shouldn't be, I mean, he's an American citizen, but he should not be elected to any office ever again. And the good people of Alabama decided that he should be the Supreme Court Justice again. And that, of course, scares me more than Roy Moore. I mean, Roy Moore is just a lunatic. The guys who took over the Malherbe wildlife thing, they're lunatics. They don't understand it. The guys who are printing their own money because they're sovereign citizens, they don't understand it, but they're in basements, and it's okay. We can have them in basements. Go in your basement. It's cool. When we have them elected to the Senate and voted for by a majority of the people of the state because they have this tribal loyalty, that's a problem.
What would you counsel someone who lives in the blue bubble state of Illinois, or at least the Chicago region, who believes in constitutional governance, to do at this point to ensure that the Constitution continues to be honored in this country?
Well, the solution to an election is the next election. That's constitutional order. There were a bunch of people, and this is kind of a straw man because it wasn't serious, but there was a bunch of people who, after the election of Donald Trump in like California, were like, we should secede, because clearly we didn't vote for this guy. And I addressed that on Twitter, which is where I spend most of my time. And and what I said was, is the reason we had a civil war, well, the cause was slavery, but the immediate trigger of the civil war was that the South decided that they did not like the result of an election, in this case the presidential election of 1860, in which the Democratic pro-slavery vote was split by two candidates and the anti-slavery Abraham Lincoln was elected. And because they did not like that result of the election, they thought Abraham Lincoln would take away their slaves, they said, well, we're out. We're leaving. And in the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln does not talk about slavery. He does that later, but he doesn't talk in the Gettysburg Address. He talks about saving the idea of government by the people, for the people, and of the people shall not perish from the earth. And what he meant was that. What he meant was the idea that you would honor an election even if you really didn't like the result, that you would continue to be a part of the body politic even if you didn't win. And democracy is really, really hard. It's designed that way. So if you don't like the way that your government, be it the government of Oak Park, and I know our mayor is here, or the government of Illinois, or the government of Cook County, or the government of the United States of America, complaining about it on Twitter is not going to change things. Ranting about it from a stage like this is not going to change things. Elections will change things. So if you're unhappy with any election, and this was true before we had this last one, get out there and try to sway the next election in your favor. And that's really hard. It's tedious and time-consuming, and it doesn't pay you any money, but that's what it takes.
You have done so much, so many different things, so many different fields. Is there anything that you haven't done that you aspire to do? Endeavor you'd like to undertake? I get you that one?
Yeah.
Peter challenged me.
He challenged
me before to ask him questions that he hasn't been asked before.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been really, really fortunate in that the fact that I can't think of anything. I mean, I wanted to write plays that got produced, and they got produced, and I wanted to write a book, and I wrote a book, and I can't even think of it. I wanted to run a marathon, and I ran a marathon. I ran 14 of them.
I think you should want to change the outcome of an election.
Yeah.
You seem to have a
no.
Nice touch.
I would be. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that does, if you want to really bug me, and it can segue into what I think is the ultimate point of the evening, is everything I've done is by its nature ephemeral. My radio shows vanish into the ether. My plays, obviously, they appear, and then, as Puck says, they vanish. They're gone. I don't know the quote. But I'm really impressed by those people who create institutions that are there. For example, my friend Marnie Ware, who's here, we'll talk about this later, she found this abandoned soccer field behind her high school where she teaches, and she looked at it and she said, I'm going to make that into something different, something more valuable, and she did it. She built that thing. It took a long time and a lot of years and many, many people and a lot of obstacles, but it's there now. And like most things, you can eat it, most good things. Well, you can't eat it. You can eat the things that come from it. And I kind of envy and aspire to. Because those are the things, a university, a school, a farm, a charity, a business even, that to me is impressive. And I think, given my focal limitations, beyond my ken. So I envy those people who do that.
On to, wait.
Oh, yes.
Tell me.
Yes.
Why is there no punctuation between wait and wait in the title? There should be a comma, an ellipsis, a dash, something, but there isn't.
I don't know. And I will, go on and say something further. I hate the title of my radio show. I have always hated the title of my radio show. The radio show was named by Bob Garfield, who was working at NPR at the time. He's now the host of On the Media, which is a fine name. He got a good name, and he came up with that. They were trying to come up with a name for this new quiz show, and he said it. And I hate it because, A, I don't like the titles that are sentences or phrases in general. I don't like that. And secondly, it has doomed me to basically what I imagine is now a lifetime of people coming up and saying, hey, wait.
Sorry.
It's all right.
You know, it's part of the gig.
It's the gig. That's what I get, right? And, you know, every now and then, Tom Baudet and I sit around and we commiserate about this. Because I get, wait, are you Peter? And he gets, hey, it's Tom Baudet, will you leave the light on for me? And it's just, you know, and he's benefited tremendously from that ad campaign, and he has a lovely home, and he supports himself. He knows that's the price he pays, and I feel the same way. But I sometimes wish that the show was called, hey, I'm an asshole. So that's what people would have to say if they wanted to do that joke.
Let's just start with a comma.
All right. So you're saying, it's wait, ... Don't tell me exclamation part, right?
Yeah, something right. Something between wait and wait.
There's nothing wait, there. Comma, I will let, you know, what's interesting is, and there's nothing public radio fans like more than correcting your grammar. Grammar and or facts of small trivial facts. Like sometimes I will call a gorilla a monkey just to give them something to write in about because they love it so much. But you're the first person to bug me about punctuation. So congratulations.
Thank
Charlie
you.
Mars.
Thank you very much. Yeah. While we're on the subject of things that you hate, I was surprised to hear you speak with some vigor about the place where you work.
The word you're looking for is hate, and the place where I work is Navy Pier. Navy goddamn Pier.
It's beautiful. It's lovely. It's on the lake. It's wonderful.
Navy
views.
Fucking Pier.
There's a fun house. There are kids laughing and people eating. And
there are fat people from Nebraska wandering around, wondering why they were told to go there.
There's a Ferris wheel.
Navy Pier, I hope, is true and proud Chicagoans. You've never been. Shakespeare Theater's okay. Shakespeare Theater, Children's Museum, Shakespeare Theater, those are perfectly acceptable. They're great, in fact. I love both. But here's the problem with Navy Pier. So Navy Pier, you may have noticed, is sticking out into the lake, which is fine in and of itself. It's nice to have something that sticks in the lake. The views of the city are lovely. I'm out in the lake every day. But it's separated from the city, as you probably know, by first there's sort of a transitional space that is there, I think, to provide access to the sewage plant next to it. Then there is Lakeshore Tower, and then there is Lakeshore Drive, which of course is like a double-deckered thing coming off the bridge over the Chicago River. And then there's like this sort of expanse of Streeterville, which is still pretty desolate, even though there's some construction. So it's when it comes to Chicago, when you're at Navy Pier and you want to go to Chicago, as they say in the stupid joke about Maine, you can't get there from here. So you're stuck. So for 20 years, I've worked in Chicago, but not really. I've worked on a kind of quarantine ship moored off Chicago where I can see it, but I can't get there. And it drives me crazy. Thank you very much.
So walk us through a week of the show that you have to produce in a place you don't like.
Well, my WBEZ, I should say, is a lovely place filled with great people, and that's where my offices are, and so I couldn't ask for a better work environment and people to work with, so it's not their fault. So on Monday, our week starts on Monday, obviously, like most weeks do. We come in, we talk about last week's show, what went right, what went wrong. That's usually mostly important if we had a new panelist on. We evaluate that person. Oh, maybe we'll have them back. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll have them back, but we'll tell them this and give them a tip. And then we start gathering stuff for the week. There are certain things that we can do in advance of knowing what the week is going to be. For example, we know who the guest is going to be. We come up with a silly little quiz for the guest. That's usually Monday. Tuesday, we've started to accumulate news stories. We've been looking in the internet all day. Oh, here's a funny story. Here's a funny story. Here's an odd story. Here's a funny little thing. Oh, here's a story that's so crazy. Like, to use last week's example, here's a story about a guy who has an emotional support squirrel and his housing authority won't let him keep it. Oh, that's good. Pin that on the wall. That could be our crazy bluff story. Keep that there. We talk about it on Tuesday. Wednesday, we start writing the show. So I'll get up, as tradition has it, that I'll write the first draft at the top of the show where we hit, like, the big stories of the week's news. Now, I should say that this has changed significantly, like everything else has, because in the old days, we would be desperate to find a major news event to fill the top segment. Is this important enough? Is this, oh, you know, there was a big baseball game? I don't know. We can try to make it. Now, of course, the problem is the opposite. What of the extraordinary fiascos, disasters, and terrifying omens that have happened this week shall we choose to address? You know. And we sort of do that triage. We write. I read out all the things that everybody's written. We kibitz. We have a sort of standard writer's room process. If you know anything about, like, how sitcoms are made, we pitch jokes to each other. We comment. We try to come up with better ideas. Sometimes, I always say you have to write 5 bad jokes before you come up with a good one. And then Thursday, we do that whole process again. We write. Bill Curtis joins us. We read. We rehearse the script. Again, we kibitz. We rewrite furiously. We go down to the theater and we perform it at 7:30. We do the same thing if we're on the road. And then Friday, the show is then edited by our team of editors and then sent out into the world.
Are you involved in the editing process?
I am not. Turn that over. If I were, there would be a lot more me. And a lot more abstruse references to the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. So it's probably good that I am not involved in the editing.
What's been your most difficult hosting experience in your years at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
There are a bunch of stories, I guess. I hate to go to this, but it just leaps to mind, which is right after 9/11. We had been on the show, we'd been in the air for a couple of years, and 9/11 happened. And I don't know, it's kind of hard to remember. We all remember it, obviously, but it's harder to remember what it felt like, although we had a recent reminder. You felt like nothing was ever going to be the same. You felt like everything you'd believed in about the world had changed radically and in a bad way. And more to the point, if you're me, you're thinking, no one is ever going to want to hear our stupid jokes about the week's news again, because it turns out that the week's news, what we thought was funny, could actually kill you. And we didn't know what to do. We had some time to think about it because NPR canceled all the entertainment programming. No Us, no Car Talk, no anything else that week. But the next week we came back and we did a show and we actually, what are we going to do? And we talked about doing like a theme show from, hey, we're going to make jokes about history. But then we sort of decided in the spirit of the moment that we would sort of do our jobs and we'd write our show about the week's news, even though the week's news was still filled with desolation and despair and there were still cleaning up the wreckage in the World Trade Center. And we did our show, and it really wasn't a great show. If you went back and listened to it, it's not the best material. But the reaction to that show, for the first time, demonstrated to me what our show does, which is that it doesn't speak truth to power, because power doesn't care. And it doesn't change the world, because the things that change the world are not fart jokes. But it does provide relief and comfort and some small amount of joy, I am told, to people when they need it. And that week, they really needed it. And they let us know. We got a huge amount, compared especially to our audience at that time, which was probably in the hundreds of thousands. Now it's in the millions. We got a tremendous response saying, thank you, I needed that. It was lame, but I needed lame jokes. Thank you. And that's how I came to understand what value I... Because I talk about this sometimes, I'll try to make it brief. It was hard for me to reconcile myself, given my ambitions to be the great American playwright, and a very serious young man, to reconcile myself to being essentially a comedian. I remember, for example, comparing my show unfavorably to that of my friend Ira Glasses, because I thought Ira was doing really interesting journalism and first-person essays and stuff that was really interesting and fascinating, was changing the way people think about the world, and I was making fart jokes, and I felt bad in comparison. But it turns out, you know, fart jokes have a role. And I have come over the years to understand that the role of providing people comfort and joy and jokes and laughter is a privilege that we play, and by that I mean myself and my colleagues, play this really important role in people's lives. That sometimes I'm lucky enough they tell me about it. And that gives me probably more satisfaction than anything else.
I hope the answer to this next question is not the same as the answer you just gave.
Yes.
What's your favorite memory?
I have had a tremendous amount of wonderful events that have occurred to me because of this show. For example, I got to meet Barack Obama when he was a recently elected senator. That was a big moment. I got to talk to Bill Clinton. More importantly, I got to talk to Leonard Nimoy. In fact, one of the specific subcategory of pleasures I have had is getting to talk to the heroes of my youth. There are not that many left anymore, but I got a bunch of them. I got Leonard Nimoy and talked to Carrie Fisher before both of they died, but I've also talked to Carol Burnett. I mean, my God, I got to talk to Carol Burnett. I got to talk to some of my personal heroes, like Cal Ripken and Elvis Costello, right? And that's amazing. But I've also had these experiences that are absolutely insane that someone like me should have them. I played Red Rocks. I played Carnegie Hall. We played, just in that 2015 show with Chance the Rapper, whatever became of him, we... I am told, set the record for attendance in Millennium Park. They closed the gates. People were climbing over the walls to see me do my show. And that is amazing. I just can't get over it, that I've been fortunate enough to have those experiences. And that's been pretty awesome. And, you know, I've been able to travel the country. I've been in every state but two, and I've met thousands and thousands of people because of it. And so it doesn't suck.
That's all lovely, but the question was, what's your favorite?
Oh.
Pick one.
I remember, I had the crowd at Millennium Park on the opening weekend back in 2003 sing happy birthday to my daughter who had just been born. That was pretty cool.
Is that it?
That leaps to mind. I mean, we've done, I don't know. I mean, it's really been pretty awesome. And to pick one would be, I'll probably come up with it late tonight and I will call you. In fact, everybody give me your number, and I'll call you back, and that will be pretty awesome.
As sexual harassment has taken the spotlight in the national conversation, in politics and entertainment, even at NPR itself,
yes.
How has that played out in the production of your show, The Writer's Room?
Before we get to Peter Sagal's answer to that question, a test of your imagination. How would an ad for your company or an underwriting message for your organization sound right here? To learn more, email ads@chicagopublicsquare.com. That's ads@chicagopublicsquare.com. Now back to that question for Peter Sagal.
As sexual harassment has taken the spotlight in the national conversation, in politics and entertainment, even at NPR itself,
yes.
How has that played out in the production of your show, The Writer's Room, the material you'll touch?
Well, we now all sit 12 feet away from each other at all times. It's really tough. We're actually kind of weird, because one of the rules of a writer's room, if you've ever watched one or been a part of one, is there can't be any censorship. You have to be able to say anything, because the incredibly tasteless thing that you are about to say might loosen up the room and get a joke you can actually use. So if you start from the premise that there's certain things you can't say in this room, nothing good will happen. So we have some of the most obscene and horrific conversations. You would be terrified to listen to the cover. Like once, our producer Michael Danforth is a amazingly gifted mimic, and he loved to do the voice of the guy who hosted. He just died sadly. The vinyl. He's not doing anymore. The Vinyl Cafe. Stuart McLean. Stuart McLean here at the Vinyl Cafe. And there was a sex scandal. Public radio was first. There's a host named Gian Gomeshi. Remember him? He was on a show called Q, and it turns out he was an incredible sexual harasser. And he had written these horrific, obscene things. So Mike used to do, he would recite the horrific, obscene, sexual things that Gian Gomeshi had said in Stuart McLean's voice. And it was the, it was so funny. Honest to God, if there had been somebody from HR, we all would have been fired. It was terrible. The problem for us, that's a real problem. We're sort of like, can we keep saying this? Is this okay? Is this okay? We don't know. The real problem for us is making fun of it. Because we have sort of two rules, generally speaking. We make fun of people who get themselves into trouble through their human foibles. That's where we do our work. And we don't make fun of people who are victims of anything. Natural disaster, shootings, whatever. We leave them alone. And we pick on the people who screwed up. And yet, you take somebody like Harvey Weinstein, how do you make fun of him without disrespecting his victims? How do you talk about the incredibly gross things that he did without seeming to undermine the experience of the people who we hurt? And we haven't figured it out. People ask, well, why aren't comedians talking about it? Because it's really hard and it's not very funny. And we have yet to sort of crack that particular nut. I don't know if we ever will.
On to the great, great many questions submitted by the audience.
Yes.
Back to the constitutional stuff. What do you see for the future of the Trump presidency?
More hilarity. I don't know. There's something. I don't. It's hard to say. Things have happened that you can. I mean, the thing that I became obsessed with after he was elected, and I could stop. The first thing I said was, "Well, I'm old. I'll only have to endure this for a few decades, and then I'll be done." And but the thing that I couldn't get my head around is what all those ceremonial events would be like. I was thinking about like the White House Science Fair, and I was thinking about the Kennedy Center Honors, and I was thinking about the championship teams, and I'm like, what are they going to be like when you have this guy? And it turns out he canceled most of them. So he just canceled the science fair, for example. So we don't have like the image of the president looking down the barrel of a ping pong gun and going, oh. And I'm sad about that because we could have used the comic relief. So basically, every day we wake up, look at it this way. You make a prediction about the future. What are you doing? You're extrapolating from the past. You're sort of drawing a graph line. Well, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, and therefore I think that'll happen. But nothing that's happened right now has ever happened before. So how in the world do you extrapolate from absolute madness every day to what the next day's madness is going to be?
And that is the question for you.
I have no idea. Like everybody else, I did not see the election coming, so I've given up prognostication. I'm sorry. I wish I had a better answer for you. I should have prepared a funny one.
But I didn't give you the questions in advance, so you couldn't. Bill Curtis, how did he come to work on...
This is a fun... Thank you for changing the topic to something fun. So as many of you know, our original judge and scorekeeper from the very beginning was Carl Castle. Dear friend of mine, wonderful man. But the time came about 4 years ago, exactly 4 years ago. No, 3 years ago for him to retire. 4 years ago was the first time that he had to take some time off because of an illness, and Bill filled in. And I had met Bill around town. He's a wonderful man, and his wife, Donna LaPietra, basically runs Chicago. I don't know if you know that, but she does. And I had met him, and I called him up, and I said, Bill, would you like to fill in for Carl Castle? And he was great. He had a wonderful time. And then he went off to do what he does, which was basically he has his production company and his documentaries, and at the time he was hosting the evening news. They had brought him back. And he has this, he's a landed estate up in Northside. He's got a lot of stuff to do. So when Carl retired finally, we were talking about a replacement. How do you replace Carl Castle? And how do you succeed him, I should say? Nobody can replace him. And people were like, well, Bill Curtis was great. Let's get Bill Curtis back. And I literally looked around the room and I said, you people are deluding yourselves. If you think that Bill Curtis is going to want to actually, on a permanent basis, come and do our stupid radio show, he's going to like, Bill Curtis, the voice of Chicago, the guy who you hear welcoming you when you land at the airports, who narrates the goddamn U-203 exhibit or whatever it is at the Museum of Science and Industry. It was a cold day in the Pacific. That guy? You think that guy is going to want to like stand next to me and do stupid limericks? Are you kidding me? And as Bill turned to me just a few months ago and said, you're going to have to drag me out of here feet first. Because I had forgotten something that I had seen with Carl. Carl was a serious newsman. For 30 years, he got up and he came down and he did the serious news. Bill Curtis, serious newsman, here in the evening news, in the network, these documentaries, murders, deaths. What all of these people want is to be funny. All of them. And so in his 70s, we, as just as we did for Carl Castle, who was about, he was in his mid-60s when he started, but we have given Bill Curtis a chance that he's never had, to be funny, and he is enjoying it over much. For example, you may have heard him do a funding announcement for a company called Lumber Liquidators. And the phone number for Lumber Liquidators is 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the first time Bill said that, 1-800, and his, you have to imagine his voice, 1-800-HARDWOOD, and people tittered. So the next night, or the next week, he came out and he said, 1-800-HARDWOOD. And people laughed. And I swear to you, within a month or maybe three, he was stepping out from behind the podium. One, 800, hard word. And it got to the point where people stopped laughing. And he turned to me and he said, what happened? They didn't laugh at Hardwood. And I told him a story from the theater that I had been told many years ago when I was doing the same thing in a production. George S. Kaufman was doing a play, and there was a moment in the play in which, for whatever circumstances of the scene, the actor asked for a cup of tea and got a big laugh. Because it was like incongruous given what was going on. It was like there was madness and chaos and people fighting, and he said, may I have a cup of tea? And people cracked up. And then he stopped getting the laugh. It didn't happen. And he went to Kaufman. He said, Kaufman, why aren't I getting the laugh in that line? He said, that's because you're not asking for the tea, you're asking for the laugh. And I told that story to Bill. And he's backed off somewhat. Somewhat. But he's enjoying himself immensely. He's a gentleman and the kindest guy. He has a filthy sense of humor. And he is enjoying himself immensely and has become a dear friend.
Any substantial differences between working with Bill and working with Carl?
Yeah. Carl was a terrible mimic, but he tried. And his attempts to mimic people's voices was hilarious. Bill doesn't even try. With one exception, he does a freakishly good Donald Trump. He really does. Other than that, he just is like, it's a woman, it sounds like Bill Curtis. It's a Chinese person, it sounds like Bill Curtis. Doesn't matter.
Next question from the audience.
Yes.
From the audience. What is your favorite cookie?
Oh, good one.
And nuts or no nuts?
Oh, geez. Favorite cookie. I'm assuming you mean store-bought cookie, right? Because it has to be common. I mean, I can tell you this cookie I make. Oh, gosh. When I was growing up, I used to love to get those half-and-half cookies in New York, and I still have a soft spot for them, those little frosted cookies. But there's like a, oh, I can see it. Oh, you know what I love? Those little wafer cookies they give you on planes sometimes? Those are great! I ask for extra.
So that's no nuts.
That's no nuts. That's okay. A no-nut cookie.
Who was your favorite guest?
Ah, tricky question. I get asked that a lot, and I still don't have a good answer. I hosted my father once. He was the guest on like Father's Day 1999 when nobody was listening, and I enjoyed that a lot. He did too. And he immediately started telling the other panelists funny stories about me as a child, which was why we've never had him back.
You're, as you've acknowledged, a fan of science fiction.
I am.
And fantasy. What is your favorite?
I grew up on Star Trek, the original series. And I never really got into the many sequels, so I was a Star Trek, which was why it was such a huge thrill to meet Leonard Nimoy. And by the way, what was really interesting about Leonard Nimoy was, I don't know if you know anything about Leonard Nimoy, but he spent a period of time in his life being very upset about being identified with Spock. He wrote a book called I Am Not Spock, because he was a serious actor and an artist, and he did not want to be associated with this dumb TV show that only ran for 3 years. But when he met us, and long before this, he had sort of come to embrace it. He had understood that because he had done this dumb TV show that ran for 3 years, people all over the world loved him. And that doesn't suck when you're in your 70s, as you were when you met him. So I try to remember that, that do, if people love you, don't question their reasons. But what was the question? Oh, big science fiction. I love that. But I was also a literary science fiction reader. I had thousands of those paperback books that you with lurid covers. It was through science fiction that I got lured into Kurt Vonnegut, because Kurt Vonnegut wrote these sort of faux science fiction novels like Sirens of Titan and Slaughterhouse-Five, most preeminently. He, in fact, invented a science fiction author named Kilgore Trout, who shows up in a lot of his books. And because of science fiction and a particular book called The Sirens of Titan, which had three very attractive women painted on the cover, and I was at an age where that was really enticing to me, I passed into a fandom of Kurt Vonnegut, which lasted my whole life. And the Kurt Vonnegut Library, a couple years ago down in Indiana, gave me an award, which made me very, very happy because I grew up on Vonnegut.
When you've interviewed people for your Not My Job segments, which answer has surprised you most?
Oh, gosh. There have been so many questions. I can tell you like some fun sort of spontaneous moments. Like, for example, we had Paula Deen on the show. This is before we found out that Paula Deen was also bad. And we asked her to go look in what was in her refrigerator, which was awesome. And she went, she just walked into that room and did that. We've had people who've cheated. We've had people who've like asked their, once we had Nina Totenberg call in drunk.
On purpose?
No.
This wasn't like drunk history.
We tape at 7:30 starting here Central Time, and it gets to be like 8:30 before we have these people call in, and that's 9:30 Eastern Time, and they're into dinner and drinks, right? So she was a little toasted. So was Yo-Yo Ma, by the way. That was kind of odd. I can't say it was fun, but it was odd. Gosh, I should really think more about these questions. I'm sorry about that.
What's the hardest wait segment for you and your team to create?
The hardest is really, at least as far as I'm concerned, at the top of the show. And the reason is because that's the part of the show where we have to do the obligatory stuff, i.e. the major news event of the week. And so we're not starting from a presumption that it's funny. Like all the other stuff in the show, the bluff story, the other questions we ask, that's stuff that we found funny to begin with, right? And I always say, nothing you can make up is better than the truth. So if we find stuff that's really funny, that I say, you know, it was an emotional support squirrel, then that's great, and we don't have to add a lot to that. We can just tell the truth. But the opening segment, which we work the hardest on, is that's where we're saying, well, we have to talk about the election. We have to talk about the speech. We have to talk about whatever just happened. And we have to find humor, sometimes in situations where the humor is not apparent, and we have to do it in a way that strikes our listeners as original and fresh and not something they've heard all week on Colbert Show and Seth Meyers and Samantha Bee Show and on Twitter, which is a huge competitor to us now because people are a lot of amateur comedians on Twitter. And that's hard sometimes, and sometimes we don't succeed, but sometimes we do, but that's probably the hardest part.
Who's inspired you most in your life?
Who has inspired me most in my life? That is another really good question that I haven't thought about enough. I have been very lucky in that I have met interesting people at certain times of my life that have inspired me to do the next thing.
Norman Schneider in high school, my drama teacher, who encouraged and inspired me to pursue the theater, which became my thing for the first part of my career. A professor named Robert Chapman at college at Harvard, who was one of the great teachers at Harvard for many years. He taught Updike, and I took his classes and learned a lot about literature and the joy of life from him, and also how to make an excellent martini. When I was in Los Angeles, my first time out of college, I met amazing writers who my theater was doing, people like Tony Kushner, Donald Margulies, Marlena Meyer, a wonderful woman probably who was the answer to your question, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't immediately think about her. But her name was Jo Carson. She's no longer with us, very sadly. And Jo was somebody who spent her entire life in one town, Johnson City, Tennessee, as a writer. And she wrote about the people where she was from. In fact, her whole life's mission was to prove that the stories that people had from where they were worth telling, no matter where they were from. And one night, because she had written a play that myself and a colleague of mine had picked out of a pile and thought was really of value, and we got it produced. Probably the most significant thing I did during that period of my life when I was working at a theater was get this play produced, and it won an award, which was huge for Jo because she needed the money, and It was a big deal. And I remember one night I was sitting around and I was telling Jo a story of my family. And she said, you should write that down. That's a play. You should go write that. And I had not thought that that story of my family was worth it. But she told me it was. And because of that, I went and I wrote that play, which was a terrible play because I didn't know what I was doing. But I found out that the stuff of my life, what I thought, experienced, saw, could be of value and could be written down into a coherent form. And so my next play was better. My next play was better, and I started the career as a playwright. So she's probably the person. She was meeting her was a great gift.
Whom have you been most proud to have inspired? People who have come to you and said, I wouldn't be where I am without you.
Not a lot of people say that to me.
Okay, I'm inspired.
Well, thank you. No, I mean, I don't know. I don't get a lot of that, frankly, and I don't need to get a lot of that. I don't think that I'm an inspiring figure. I think that I am an entertaining figure, I hope, or a comforting figure, I hope, and many people have told me that. I don't know how much time we have, but this is my favorite story about that. Like I said, we get lots of stories, people saying, oh, I was going through a hard time, and you helped us. We were going down to Charleston, South Carolina, and before we went, we got a heartfelt email, and it was from a woman who was talking about her partner, another woman, and she said, my partner got very, very ill and was in a coma. And the doctors told us, we've done everything we can for her. It's really up to her in her coma whether she wants to live or die, if she wants to come back or continue going over to the other side. So if you want to help her, give her some incentive to come back. Give her something she likes. So the letter writer told me, we put in a boombox and we just played episodes of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me because she really loved your show. And she woke up. Possibly just to say, turn that off, but, and we were just, oh my God, we were amazed. We restored someone to life. So we said, you have to come see our show and come backstage and meet us. And they came backstage and there she was and she was healthy and it was great. And we met them both and it was awesome. And it was either the most extraordinary compliment you could ever pay to someone in my line of work or the most elaborate yet successful scam to get free tickets to a radio show. Either way, it was impressive.
I have no context for this question. Did you ever get the guitar back that your daughter left in the alley?
Oh, my God. Who knows about that? That is amazing. And the answer is no. My daughter, now at the University of Chicago, was taking guitar lessons from, oh, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. I'm an old man, but he's here in town. He teaches everybody guitar. He's part of Tributosaurus, wonderful guy. What? Thank you, Kurt Morrison. Thank you very much. Wonderful guy. I'm embarrassed I didn't think of him. But my daughter was taking lessons from Kurt. And one day she rode her bicycle over. And she rode her bicycle back with a guitar strapped to her back like a folk singer. I thought it was cool. And the next day she's like, where's my guitar? And I'm like, I don't know. What's a guitar? Where is it? You can't put it under your bed. And it turns out that she had taken it off her back, put the bicycle in our little shed, and then walked into the house. And the guitar disappeared. So we never got the guitar back, and then we were sort of trying to, and I was thinking, well, that was a very expensive guitar. It wasn't actually hers. It belonged to her mother, and she lost it, so we should probably come up with some way for her to pay us back to get her a new guitar. And I was working through that when her mother took her out and bought her a new guitar. So
one of the many reasons we're no longer married.
And I have to emphasize, these questions come from the audience. This is our last question. How many people who have interviewed you have wound up as guests on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
None, but you never know.
Peter Sagal, on stage at Dominican University in River Forest, Illinois, November 20th, 2017, part of the Wednesday Journal Conversation Series. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Thanks for listening.